From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a new article she's written for The Atlantic magazine, Hannah Rosen says pretty much as soon as teenagers got camera phones, they started using them to send naked photos of themselves. The grown-ups do it too, of course, but Rosen says the speed with which teens have incorporated sexting into their mating rituals has taken society by surprise. And we don't really know what to make of this sexting trend or what to do about it. Today in the program, Rosen will join us to explain what she's learned about it, like who does it, more kids than you might think, by the way, why they do it, it's not always about the sex, and this question, is it mostly just a harmless form of sexual experimentation, or is it hurting young people? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So let me begin by directing a question to the parents of teenagers out there, particularly the older teens, juniors and seniors. What would you do if you found out your kid was sending naked photos of herself or himself to a boyfriend or a girlfriend? You'd be worried for sure, outraged maybe, but why? Put aside the moral part for just a moment, and even put aside the fact that these kinds of photos can be used for shaming and bullying and even creepier reasons. We'll talk about that part too. But if it was voluntary, if it was consensual, is it just another expression of teenage sexuality, another form of experimentation? Or is there something else here in a sext? Should it be illegal, for example, as it is in most states across the country? For example, is it child porn? What are parents supposed to do about it? What about law enforcement? Underneath all of that may be a bigger question. Why do teens sext? Today in the program, Hannah Rosen is with us to take us through some of these questions. She's written an article about teens and sexting in the November issue of The Atlantic magazine. We're hoping to hear from you, too, if you have your own questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Hannah Rosen is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. She's the author of the book The End of Men. Her article, which I mentioned, is called Why Kids Sext. It's the cover article of The Atlantic's November issue. There's a link to it on our website. And Hannah Rosen is joining us today from The Atlantic's offices in Washington, D.C. And Hannah Rosen, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, so I want to start here. When you got started with this story, you have daughters, you've pointed this out. What did you think about sexting? I mean, what was your gut reaction to the idea? Because I'm trying to get a sense of how that may have changed your perspective as you were learning more about it.
Oh, it absolutely changed. I mean, when I started, I have one teenage daughter, and she's a young teenager, so I'm kind of new to these thoughts. And when I first started researching this, I immediately said to her, never send a sext for any reason. It's just crazy. You'll get in trouble. You know, it can do you nothing but harm in your life. And because you read about these stories in the media of the disaster cases, basically, a high school where someone sends it sext, all the kids see it. You know, sometimes even the girls end up committing suicide. I mean, basically, what filters up to us are the disaster cases.
The case study that you use in your article to kind of explore sexting is the story that I guess you heard about in the newspaper or on the news or something like it. It's a story that plays out in Louisa County, Virginia. This is in central Virginia, Louisa County High School. Get us started with this story. So as you start in the article, this mother, a woman by the name of Jennifer, she gets this late night call from a friend of her daughter, 15-year-old daughter. And her friend is calling to say Jasmine, it's not her real name, obviously. She says Jasmine is on a web page and she's naked. And the story sort of starts from there. Give us a sense of how this story plays out first so we can break it down.
Yes, it's every parent's worst nightmare. You get this call, the person sends you a link, you look and you see there indeed is a picture of your young teenage daughter naked. And then you try and call the police or try and figure out what's going on. People try and gather information. They realize there's about 100 pictures of girls from the middle school and high school, the local school, naked up on a public Instagram page. Yeah. And somebody finally reaches the police. The police have a direct line to Instagram, so they do shut down the page pretty quickly. But now it's their job to figure out what's going on. And the law is very confusing. A police office doesn't get really much guidance because any picture of a minor is considered child pornography. So on the one hand, you've got this pretty draconian felony that you're looking at. And on the other hand, is it's becoming increasingly clear to the police officers as they're calling kids in, this is common kid behavior.
Right.
You know, so they're calling in kid after kid and saying, well, do you know anybody else who has naked pictures of kids on their phones? And the kids are saying, are you kidding me? Like, here's five names for you or here's 10 names for you. Because it's a small enough town that people know the investigators, and so they kind of trust them. You know, it's a school resource officer. He's in there all the time. And so suddenly they've got bins full of cell phones. So they're faced on the one hand, which was something that's technically in Virginia law a felony, and on the other hand, a completely common teenage behavior. So they're stuck.
Yeah. Donald Lowe is this chief deputy, as you said. He knows these kids, and he's kind of baffled by all of this because on one hand, he knows some of these kids have done something kind of stupid and kind of reckless. But he also knows that in most of these cases, it's not really exploitation or it's not really cyber shaming. It's just normal behavior of I guess, of kids in the digital age. Do we need to talk about what that word normal means? If that because it seems like the idea of normal seems an important part of this story.
Yeah, I mean, the papers initially reported it as a sexting ring.
Yeah.
Now, that word ring is incredibly sinister. You know, we think of pedophiles, we think of manipulated behavior when we hear the word ring. You know, so that was kind of alarming. But then it turns out if you look at the studies of teenagers in the upper teen years, so we're talking about, you know, 16, 17, 18, about a third of them consistently report that they sexted.
Right.
So that's not the majority, but it's a high enough number that it's considered pretty normative behavior. So everybody knows someone who does it. If you ask teenagers, they'll say, oh yeah, everybody does it. But by everybody, they just mean, you know, it's kind of there in the air in their life. So it's just a part of their life. And this is terrible, frankly, because a naked picture of a minor, I mean, it's not a terrible thing to do. We'll get there eventually. But I mean, it's very difficult for the culture and law enforcement now to know what to do. Because as we all know, a naked picture of a minor out there in the world is a very fraught and loaded thing.
It seems like, I wonder, this question of whether this is normal or whether this is just really common, should we start the process of kind of stripping out the moral reaction we have to all of this, or even the kind of naturally protective reaction we have? Not get rid of it, but because you write in your article, we adults inadvertently step into the role of Freddy Krueger, making teenage nightmares come true. What you mean is we tend to overreact and we turn these into cases that may even be get worse, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, just it's actually worse than that. I mean, you have to, in a lot of these cases, the humiliation comes from the fact of adult involvement. So, for example, you know, a totally typical case, mom finds a naked picture on a son or daughter's cell phone, freaks out, calls the other parent, and somehow it becomes a case. Like, the parents don't agree, the teachers and administrators get involved, maybe even the police gets involved. The humiliation for the teens is not in the initial sending of the sext, you know. That's just part of that's part of life for teenagers. I mean, if they're sexually active and they have cell phones, which almost all teenagers do nowadays, this is just kind of part of the DNA of how they communicate with each other. And we can talk about whether we think that's good or cool or whatever. But so the humiliation comes from the overreaction, because now, you know, in a typical case, say this one in Louisa County, you've got, you know, a lot of girls, because you're going to call the girls in first because you have their pictures, so you know who they are. You still don't know, you know, who the boys that are involved, where the pictures came from, who put up that Instagram page. You're going to call in a bunch of girls to talk to largely male law enforcement operator, you know, officers about their naked pictures. So where's the trauma going to come from? It's going to come from that. Mm-hmm. So you have to be delicate around that.
And you point out most of the girls were embarrassed by it, And a lot of them felt, you know, betrayed by some of these photos. They didn't know that they were headed toward this Instagram page. But you say most weren't really devastated. They weren't really all that surprised by it.
Yeah. I mean, there is this idea that pictures get out. It's not shocking to people that that happens. It actually happens a lot less often than I thought it did. It's a really small minority of cases. And yet the specter of a picture escaping from its original target phone is you know, something that we hear about. So it's not that they were absolutely shocked. And then I will say, I think it's important to mention there was a small minority, really just like one or two girls, who seemed to have been proud of it. You know, they may have even sent their pictures directly to the guys who were setting up the Instagram page, and their attitude to the officers was, you know, leave me alone, my body, my choice, what business is this of yours? You know, it's perfectly legal for two teenagers to have sex, so why, if I want to send my picture, like, what do you care? Yeah. You know, so that was one of the strains that was out there. It was a minority, but it existed.
Right. Part of this question comes up, are these girls and or are these boys, for that matter, who get caught up in this generally, are they victims? Because Major Donald Lowe, he's this chief deputy we mentioned, he came to see it, you say in the article, with, I guess, kind of some nuance. His thinking morphed from seeing the girls on Instagram as victims to something a little bit more complicated. Explain what you mean, because and on some level, he says they sort of victimized themselves, at least some of them did.
Yeah, I mean, because sexting, because we haven't identified where the harm is, and all sexting is a crime at some level, even if it has a lesser penalty. You know, a girl who sends a sext to her boyfriend, let's say, or a boy to his girlfriend, because boys do it just as often.
Right.
You know, are they a victim, or is this? Or have they victimized themselves, as he said, because they sent this picture? So even though they technically count as a victim, you know, it was totally voluntary. I mean, the law has a very strange name for this, which is self-produced child pornography. Mm-hmm. You know, which is odd if you think about it, because child pornography laws are designed to protect children from adults. So if you have this other category called self-produced child pornography, what do we think of the person who produced it? Now, I will say Donald Lowe came around to a different position, which is, I think, the absolutely correct position, which is what we should focus on is the non-consensual use of these photos.
Right.
This is something our law is very bad at doing. So the crime is, very distinctly in my mind, who put up that Instagram page? Who used those pictures in ways that they were not intended to be used, and even worse, put them on a public page that anybody could access? That, to me, should be the crime, not the just kind of sending your picture to, you know, a boyfriend or a girlfriend.
It was interesting that you say the kids who heard the message, you know, you'd hear these messages from parents, from grown-ups who say, look, think about this down the line when you're looking for a job or you want to get into the military. I mean, this stuff is going to come up, so you have to be really careful. But you say the kids that were hearing that message seemed, as you put it, strikingly blasé.
Yeah,
what do you make
blah,
of that?
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I mean, Donald Lowe, you know, he did that sort of finger motion where it's like lips flapping, blah, blah, blah. He would give this sort of stern, serious speech to all of the kids because he eventually sort of let them go and did focus on the people he thought were the criminals here. And they just, it was like in one ear and out the other. What do I make of that? Educators have gotten a little more sophisticated about this because it's now been a few years that as part of sex education, you can find educators out there who have been talking to students. The reason it's blah, blah, blah is because their experience tells them that mostly that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Mostly it doesn't get out. It doesn't ruin your life. It doesn't end up on an Instagram page. So I think that the wiser educators say you can't go in there and say to them, if you send a sect, it's going to get out to all your friends, the way all these education campaigns do, by the way, and your social life is going to be ruined and it's going to pop back up on Instagram. It's just unusual. So they don't hear it as the truth. They see you as somebody who's out of it and doesn't know what you're talking about.
Hmm.
Now, there is a better way to give the message. You want me to say it?
Yeah, go ahead. I was going to come around to that. No, hold off, actually, because I want to spend a little bit more time with why they sexed. And that was really a surprising part I think, of the story. Let's take a break first, though. We can get back to that. Hannah Rosen is with us, correspondent for the Atlantic magazine. Her article, Why Kids Sext, appears in this month's issue of the magazine. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. I'd like to hear from you parents out there, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Need to take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Hannah Rosen is with us. She's been exploring the issue, the question of sexting. She's here to help us understand why young people are doing this, which may surprise you, some of the reasons, by the way, and how you manage the legal and social boundaries of sexting. Her article, which is in the November issue of the Atlantic magazine, is called Why Kids Sext. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I wanted to ask you about, you sort of made a reference to this earlier, how many kids, and it's mostly older teens who are doing this, are sexting. It's not, as you say, it's not rare, but it's also not universal. And I guess we should also point out, adults are doing more of it than teens. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, because there's no danger for adults. They can do whatever they want. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So does it change? Do we know? You didn't put this in your article, but I wondered, since this is Utah, environments where there are large, you know, populations of religious people. I'm thinking of the Bible Belt, for example, Utah in particular, Mormon culture. Do the dynamics change much related to that? Do we have any idea?
Boy, do I wish I knew the answer to that question. That's a fabulous question, and I don't know, but I would guess not, because sexual behavior doesn't change in the way that we think it does.
Yeah. Why do kids sext?
It's a big question, and there's lots of answers. I'll tell you a surprising one that I learned. Some kids, especially slightly younger kids, told me that they sext because they think of it as safe sex. Yeah. There's a way in which kids today are much more highly monitored by their parents. They don't just kind of hang out at the mall the way, frankly, I used to when I was a kid. They have a lot of activities. They have a lot of homework, after school stuff. Parents don't let them kind of drive and visit a boyfriend maybe as casually as they used to. And so this is their form of intimacy. Late at night when you finish your homework, you know, your parents are doing what they're doing. You're on Instagram or on Twitter. You know, this is how you are intimate, basically, with someone who is your boyfriend. And they think it's safe. You know, they're nervous about actual sex, which actually teenagers today, their first age of sex has gone up over the last few years, not down. In other words, they're older when they have their first sexual encounter. So it's safe to them. Yeah. That's one. It's not the majority. The majority is what you think. I sexed because I'm in a relationship and my boyfriend and girlfriend asked me for a picture. That's the vast majority of reasons that people sext, which is to say, parents, that it probably means that your child is sexually active or soon to be sexually active. Yeah, it doesn't mean it's an indicator of that risky.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an indicator. It's an indicator. I think that's been proven pretty strongly. Some papers will see that and report, you know, sexting linked to dangerous behavior. Now, it depends if you think teenage sex is dangerous or not, right? It is linked to sexual activity.
That's about as much as we know. Yeah, well, you do ask the question whether sexting is a form of sexual activity or if it's a gateway to sexual activity. What do we know about that?
We don't know much about whether it's a gateway. People seem to understand it now as a form, just kind of a thing unto itself that probably indicates you're having sex, but that isn't like first you sexed, that makes you interested in sex, and then you have sex. It's not really like that.
One thing you discovered was that sexting was at times really only loosely about sex because their lives are so planned out and so scheduled that sexting is just part of a kind of an intimate conversation, that it wasn't so much about the sex part, which gets us to the sexual fantasy thing. I'll ask you about that here in a moment. But it's only loosely about sex. It's more social in some ways than sex.
Yeah, it's about trust. Yeah. You know, do you trust me enough to send me a picture? Because they know there's a lot of the conversation around sending a sext is, will you send it to anyone else? You know, erase it as soon as I send it to you. Do you love me enough to send it to me? You know, it's questions of trust more than it is sexual and about fantasy. That was surprising to me. And in terms of fantasy, a lot of it is about social status. You know, where boys especially will talk about, well, whose do you have? How many do you have? The sort of count them up. That's the less savory part of it. So the girls would say, oh, yeah, it's like they're collecting baseball cards or Pokemon cards. You know, it's not that meaningful to them. They just collect them. You know, and that's partly because there's so much free online porn, frankly. So they use sexts for different reasons.
Yeah. It's not about the sexual fantasy part. You make this reference to a gay Talese book. Talk about that, because I think that's interesting. That it shows the difference between this was probably the 70s or 80s, I guess it might have been, and now the digital era. They're really different times.
Thy Neighbor's Wife, which is a gay Talese book about the sexual revolution, published in the 80s, but about the whole revolution through the 60s and 70s, is one of my favorite books. And it opens on a scene of a boy looking at his favorite, what they called then, and I think an art magazine. It was a euphemism for a porn magazine. It was sort of pre-Hustler, pre-Penthouse kind of magazine. And his relationship with this woman in this picture is extraordinary. I mean, he has kind of elaborate fantasies about her. He treats this magazine, as I wrote, with archivist's care, you know, that it doesn't get wet, it doesn't get destroyed. He has looked at these pictures, clearly from Gay Talese's description, hundreds and hundreds of times, has probably logged many hours looking at pictures of this woman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the boys will look at the sext for like seconds. You know, with all the drama around the sexting, the actual time they spent, you know, looking at the picture is just like seconds, not even a minute.
Yeah, it wasn't about the titillation part today.
Yeah, or evaluating the picture. It wouldn't be the launch for any of your fantasies. I mean, you know, the world moves much faster. And, you know, depressingly, and this is the depressing part to me, all the online porn, which I would be more worried about than I would about the sexting in many ways.
Let's take a call, 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. John is with us in Sandy. John, welcome.
Yes, how are you?
I'm fine. Go ahead.
Well, I think, obviously, I've been working with communities for about a decade now trying to help educate on the dangers of pornography, and I think, you know, we probably ought to just focus on the children. I mean, anybody over 18, I don't think we really have any say, but any those younger children, I think just kind of letting them know what they could be getting into and how some of those images could get out there and destroy their lives. I think that's just probably the best thing is to just let them know, educate them, and create awareness of what could happen.
Well, what do you think about that, though, Hannah Rosen? I mean, you are talking about what you're saying is something very distinct from just, I mean, isn't this part of the, John, but isn't that part of the problem, Hannah Rosen, that the people aren't making the distinction between pornography and child pornography and what sexting actually is?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is about what's voluntary, what's consensual, who's at the other end of the sext, why are you sending the sext? I mean, we didn't get too deeply into this, but a parent who sees a naked picture in a kid's phone and takes away the phone and grounds them, which is what a lot of parents do, isn't really getting very far, because what you need to do is find out what's going on around that sext. In a way, I mean, I know this is horrible and probably makes parents really uncomfortable, but you could almost consider yourself lucky that you have a way to find stuff out. It's like, look, there's this picture. Who were you sending it to? Because if you find out your kid was sending it to someone they barely know, someone they want to be their boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, you can probably sniff out whether this is just kind of average sexual experimentation of a kind you, when you were a teenager, could recognize as, you know, okay, if unsavory for a parent to hear about, or if it sounds like something a little more dangerous and risky, you know?
Yeah. I wonder, how much of this did you get a sense is a reflection of self-esteem for girls in particular? Do you get a sense that, I mean, you point out that you yourself were, I've heard you talk about the fact you were pretty self-conscious when you were a teenager, that you would never have shared a naked photo of yourself. So is there something that has changed? And I mean, there are obvious physical things that have changed in the culture, but is there something particularly different about all of this?
Yeah, I mean, the literature now is starting to get sophisticated and distinguish between pressured sexters and non-pressured sexters. So the pressured ones are the ones where, you know, a boy will send 20 or 30 to sex and they doesn't really know them and say, send me your picture, and then the girl does it, and that turns out to have bad consequences. But if you think of pressure more broadly, and I've thought about this a lot, there is pressure on girls to think that this is kind of normal, even when they don't feel that way internally themselves. And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, when I was a kid, you know, there were some pop stars whose thing was to be like really sexy, you know, bearing midriff, and there are some who weren't. Like, there were all kinds. Whereas now, pretty much all of them are really sexy. And so you get the sense that that's just the way a girl is. Like, that's the way a girl presents herself out in the world. And, you know, for some girls, that may work out. It may align with how their personality is naturally. And for other girls, it might not. So they may just do something before they're ready. So I do think there's a lot of pressure. In the best of all possible worlds, you'd think then maybe these pictures would lose some of their sting, you know? Like, if we see it all the time, like, why should it ruin a girl's reputation or be such a big deal or, you know, cause anyone to commit suicide? That would be an okay outcome of this situation. But on the other hand, you do get the sense that, you know, girls just think that's what you do, and so they feel obliged to comply.
Do we have any idea what percentage are just two teenagers consensually and voluntarily sending each other sex, and how much of this is more the more exploitative, creepier type? Do we know what the...
Oh, yeah. It's vastly the former. Yeah. I mean, we're in the like 70, 80, 90%. That's why when you say to kids it's going to be a disaster, they don't listen to you.
Right.
Because it's like huge percentage of them are just, you know, send me a picture, I'll send you a picture. You know, I just want to turn this back around, because the educators do say, you know, you can tell kids don't send to sex, but you have to come in wisely and say, make the seatbelt analogy. You know, we don't wear our seatbelt in the car because we think we're going to get into a fatal car crash every time. We wear a seatbelt because we think there, even though there is a small chance of a fatal car crash, if it happens, it could be really devastating. So it's something like that. It's kind of in the way that you present the dangers, so you sound like you know what you're talking about, that you understand that that's not the likely outcome, but that it's still a possible outcome, and if it happens, it's pretty bad.
I was interested in the class dynamics of the story you wrote, because you write about how the so-called elite girls in the school saw some of the girls in the photos who had appeared on that Instagram page, you know, as sluts. But you say it wasn't just because their photo was on the page, but it was also related to what they looked like or how they acted. There's such a social dynamic, this idea of establishing that kind of moral superiority or your social status that seemed to be a part of that.
Yeah, people who research the word slut are more and more noticing that it has less to do with a girl's sexual behavior than a way of policing class boundaries. Mm. So an upper class girl will call another girl a slut, meaning like she dresses trashy, like it's about the brands that you wear or what you look like, or you live in a double wide trailer, whatever. It's like it's a way of pointing out your social status. And the reverse is also true. So sort of a working class girl will look at an upper class girl and call her a slut, by which, you know, some studies have shown that means like a rich sorority girl or something. So it's a way for girls to police each other while not denying themselves the ability to be sexually active. It's very interesting, all the research about slut and how girls use it.
The double standard is interesting too. I wanted you to say something about that. There's a girl you call Brianna. That's not her name, but you write about what she went through. Which brings up the question, you describe it this way, the ancient, maddening, and cruel double standard. Take us through that, if you would, because Brianna's experience was really sad, disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most interesting part of, the most depressing part of the story, is I would hang out with a group of 14 and 15-year-old boys in the library, and they're basically talking to me about their game, you know, how does your game work, you know, and they'll say, oh, we say to the girl, you're so beautiful, I want to see your body's so beautiful, and then the girl will send them a picture, usually late at night, they may wake up in the morning with the picture, and I'd say, then how do you feel about her? And they immediately would say, she's a hoe. like right away, you know? And so you think, like, how infuriating is that? And one of the main girls that I follow through the story essentially had this experience where she was not sending the picture to somebody who was already her boyfriend. It was to somebody who she didn't know that well, who kept asking, which, by the way, is always a bad idea.
Yeah.
That I can cleanly tell my daughter, always a bad idea. So she's sending it to someone who she wants to be her boyfriend, as opposed to somebody who she already has some connection and commitment from. And, you know, he immediately treats her terribly the minute she sends it. So it's the ancient, you know, morning after problem.
Yeah. Boys and girls are equally likely to have sent a sext, you say, but girls way more likely to have been asked to by boys.
Yes. Yeah, that's maybe obvious if you think about it,
yeah.
You know, how maybe it's not obvious that boys and girls are equally likely to send a sext. I think we do have the impression it's something girls do, but boys do it just as much, but girls don't ask for it. So there's actually a funny conversation you have with girls about the boys sending the sext. Now, that's very much a question of trust. You know, that's a thing that girls will say, well, you send me one, or, you know, if you want me to do it, you do it. So it really does have a lot of implications that are not sexual in the case of boys sending them. It indicates, oh, we want to move our relationship to this level. It's like a marker. It signifies something, but it's not a sexual thing in and of itself.
Here's a question from Ben, who wonders if exhibitionism figures into why kids sext. He says, it's so easy to display yourself everywhere today. Have you thought about that as a factor?
Yeah, I love that question because I think that's so uncomfortable to think about. I mean, I have 3 children, teenage daughter, the son who's going to be a teenager soon. It's just horrible. We don't want to think about the ways in which this might be fun. You know, for some reason, like, we can remember ourselves when we were teenagers and all the things that we did because, you know, that's the period of your life when you are most sexually active, when it's most dynamic, probably most exciting, also most treacherous.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really difficult to kind of call up that mind frame when we think about children. So, of course, some of this is exhibitionism. You know, I look good. I want to show myself off, or just I'm like experimenting with this crazy thing. You know, so sure, it's just very hard to think of, you know, we feel so protective of children in general, and not children, I shouldn't say, but teenagers in general, and particularly our own teenagers, that we don't like to go there.
Yeah, it's interesting you said earlier that there may be an argument for the fact that because sexting is some kind of form of experimentation and it's some kind of outlet, that teenagers may in fact be having less sex because of it. Do you think that's—
Well,
did I hear you say
you
that
know,
right?
It's not. So the way this came up in the story is around the question of child exploitation, because
right.
A lot of the reason that states do not want to pass, you know, want to lower the penalties for sexting or make that explicit is because they're very nervous about child pornographers having any out, you know, of making it easier on them in any way. So I asked the main national experts on child pornography, and it turns out that in the same period of time that sexting has exploded, crimes against children, crimes against minors have drastically dropped. Now I don't know that they're connected, but that's one guess that these guys make, is that maybe, you know, whatever dangerous situations happen often happen online instead of happening in person. So that's one element of that. But sure, you can experiment with a virtual persona and not your actual persona. You can see how, while that might be psychologically damaging or not the best thing that's going on, it's certainly less damaging than if it happens in person. And I think overall, and I do write about this as well, the kids are doing all right. Like, if you look at big markers of first stage of sexual experience, teen pregnancy, all the things that we consider possibly risky sexual behavior, they're very much on the decline.
Well, when we get back from a break, I want to talk a little bit about how lawmakers across the country are dealing with all of this, because there's an obstacle they're trying to get past. Before I do, let me ask you this question, another one that comes up. Because you write about, as soon as teenagers got camera phones, they started sending nude selfies to one another, which is a way of saying, look, we've always done that. And is this just one expression of human nature, in the sense that I'll show you mine if you show me yours, which has always been a game we've played as humans, I guess.
Yeah, but the digital age messes everything up because of how quickly the picture can spread. So sure, there was only so fast and so far a Polaroid could spread. And, you know, with these kind of pictures, it's up on Instagram and millions of people can see it instantly. So that's why it's so much more loaded now than it was before, even if the human instinct is the same.
Hannah Rosen is with us, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Her article, Why Kids Sext, appears in the November issue of the magazine. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Hannah Rosen is joining us to talk about Why Kids Sext. That's the name of her article, the cover article in the November Atlantic magazine. You can join the conversation, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So let's talk about 2009, because there's this case that played out in Pennsylvania, and it seemed to get lawmakers really throughout the country. I know in Utah they amended some of the some statutes that dealt with all of this, but lawmakers started to figure they had to adjust their laws a little bit to take into account this idea of sexting.
Yes, and about 20 laws passed what are known as sexting laws during the time when we were all thinking about this more intensely, which was around 2009. But as I argue in the story, the sexting laws in some ways made things worse and not better, because they codified in our minds this separate category of this thing called sexting as illegal. They defined it. Okay, sexting is sending pictures between minors, and even though we're going to lower the penalty, we're all going to agree that this is a matter for law enforcement. Now, what's wrong with that idea? It doesn't make a distinction between consensual and non-consensual.
Right.
So in the Virginia case I wrote about, it's equally a problem if, you know, two people who are dating send a picture to each other as if a guy, you know, sent forwards on a picture and then they make this Instagram page and post it up there without the girl's permission. Those two are equivalent acts in the laws, which in my mind is crazy. Like, we really need to focus on what the crime is. The crime is non-consensual use, not sexting itself.
Well, I mean, here's what, if you point this out, I mean, it's legal. Perfectly legal for two 16-year-olds to have sex. But if they take pictures and share them, then, I mean, technically the police really need to get involved. I mean, that's illegal.
Yeah, it's a law enforcement matter. It's a felony in many states. Yeah. In the states that don't have sexting laws, it's like a really serious crime. In the states that do, you know, it's still a minor crime. If you do it twice, it's, you know, they ratchet up the violations. Like you're a repeat offender, even if it's consensual. So, you know, so I'm really hoping with this story people get the point that we should make it clear to law enforcement and everyone else that it's non-consensual use that we worry about, and just not think too much about the consensual use, though it makes us uncomfortable.
Are people getting it? I've heard a couple of articles, interviews with you about this article, this point, where they didn't seem to get it. To be quite honest with you, they were just shocked by the idea of sexting. And do you know what I mean? I mean, how are people reacting to the article? Are you getting the reaction you hoped? Because some people seemed a little clueless.
Yeah, I mean, I think people, it's really just does not make us happy to think about teenagers and their sex lives. And the fact that we have evidence of it is terrible, right? Like, I think in some ways, without admitting it, we would prefer the era in which we just didn't know, you know, in which there was no possibility of finding photographic evidence of your son or your daughter's active sex life, you know? I mean, maybe you kind of knew, or, you know, maybe you knew something was happening at a party or the movie theater or whatever, but, you know, you didn't have to be presented with the evidence, and maybe that was more comfortable. So I think in that sense, and somehow sexting in the first the first stories that were written about it, it strikes people as extremely deviant and exhibitionist. And I think you just forget how a cell phone is like an extension of your mind and your spirit and your arm for a teenager. You know, it's just such, it's so woven into the fabric of their lives that we have a hard time. Like, people often say that adults, for example, are more distracted by their cell phones than teenagers because teenagers have kind of learned to live with it and incorporate it. Whereas for us, it's still like really a back and forth and kind of draws us in, draws us away. And it's not really like that for them.
You say in the article, sects don't create sexual dynamics. They reveal them.
That's a really important point. That was a revelation to me. And I think, you know, again, this is this idea. You see a picture, you freak out, you take away the cell phone instead of thinking, oh, I'm learning something. This is revealing something that's going on. This isn't something new. This is just a window into a sex life that already exists at some level, or sexual interest or curiosity that already exists. So you have to think of it like that. It's like, you know, it's just a little, it's a peephole. You've seen, but not something kind of new and deviant and weird.
Let me
ask, and people
you,
are still focused on that. I mean, there's still studies that are trying to link sexting to deviant sexual behavior, reckless sexual behaviors.
Yeah.
Like, is it true that people who sext also are likely to have unprotected sex or have many sexual partners? And they just, like, nothing definitive comes up. You know, one study will say yes, another study will say no. It seems that more and more the direction is this is just normative sexual experimentation, mostly.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about how parents should react or do to all of this. You have two contrasting examples in your article. There's the mother of the girl named Brianna that we talked about, and then there's the mother of the girl named Jasmine, which we haven't talked about quite yet. Those are two different examples of how parents have dealt with this. Would you talk about that?
Sure. The mother of Brianna reacted, I think, in a way that was typical of many parents in that school, because this is not the first time this has come up, and many parents I hear about, which is, take the phone away, you're grounded, how could you do this to me? You know, it was just like a shock to the mother's sense of who her daughter was and how her daughter should behave. You know, the kind of tragedy of realizing that your daughter is all grown up and has sexual interest. It fell hard upon that house. Now, Jasmine's mother is like an entirely different character. They're actually friends with each other. And she's a fabulous character in the story. She had a baby at 15. She has lots of kids by different dads. And has given her a kind of worldly life experience, but is fiercely in her kids' business, like fiercely protective of her kids and knows them extremely well and is very wise and on to them all the time. And what she says is, look, she's got two daughters about the same age. She says if her other daughter had been sexting, she couldn't have cared less. Like, this girl, she knows she's tough. She's super self-confident. She would never send any picture she didn't want to send. But this daughter, the one who was up on that Instagram page, she was angry at her and gave her a lecture because she feels like this daughter's a total pushover. You know, the example she gave is like, you know, if she's already folded the laundry the last 20 times, her siblings can say like, oh, come on. Just fold it, you know, the 21st time. It's no big deal. And then she'll always do it.
Right.
So that's what made her angry. The fact that this girl in this world couldn't stick up for herself, couldn't say no to a boy when she clearly didn't really want to do it. So it's like, no, it's a know your kid, know who's at the other end of that sext. Kind of alarm and panic will only prevent you from doing what you really need to do in that situation.
Yeah. She tells Jasmine, you know, you're not allowed to not go to school tomorrow. I know you're embarrassed, but you're going to go to school and you're going to sort of hold your head up. I mean, you know, take your lumps. But I thought that was an interesting approach, too.
Yeah, that's like working class tough love. You know,
yeah.
That was like, do not cry. If there was no processing, it's like, do not let them see you cry.
Yeah.
You know, don't, they've already got a piece of you. Don't let them get any more of you. Just ride it out. And actually, it turned out, you know, hearing the story from the kids, this mom was right in this situation. This girl, Jasmine, flew under the radar. She didn't get bullied like the other girl. She didn't get taunted. Sort of, she didn't attract drama to her. She just kind of laid low. And made it through the next couple of days and then was kind of back in business in her old self. Whereas the other girl, the one who did get into fights, whose mother was angry with her, who was very depressed about it, who really wanted to stay home from school, just kind of drama built onto drama built onto drama, and her year was absolutely miserable.
Let's take another call. Max is joining us. Max, welcome.
Hey, how you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I just had a question about the consensuality portion of this this debate. There are a handful of things that are illegal, no matter whether it's consensual or not. And I was wondering, what do you guys think about that? Because it's been brought up a couple of times that because it's consensual, then maybe there should be a lesser penalty or no penalty. But on the large scale of things, it's still illegal to send, you know, naked pictures of minors. So what should the law be changed, or should the attitude be changed?
Max, stay with us, because I kind of want to drill down on what you're saying. Hanna, what do you think?
He is right. I mean, he's catching an inconsistency here. I almost think it's enforcement that should be changed, that we should encourage law enforcement to really focus on non-consensual. You know, you can't really get into a situation where you make, you know, the kind of wide availability of naked pictures of minors, you know, completely fine in the law. I mean, I think what other countries do is they have the laws on the books. They recognize that the laws are designed to protect children from adults, and that if it's a peer-to-peer situation, you can write into the law ages. Mm-hmm. You know, we do that with sexual consent. There's no reason not to do that with, you know, this kind of thing. You know, if the minors are the same age, basically the same things we do for sexual consent, you could do for sexting.
Okay, but they haven't done that yet so far.
No. The laws are very vague. They're the kinds of laws that get written up in periods of alarm and hysteria, which was around 2009. You know, sexting, bad. You know, violation one like this. Violation, you do it a second time and this happens to you. They're very crude, the laws that were written up, and they're very few good ones.
If I could just have one more question. What about how do you say it? Not the totality of it, but of the permanency of a picture. You know, not that it can ruin your life, but the reality is things don't go away like rumors used to when we were kids. So you've got a picture, you've got hard evidence, even though it's digital. And that's something I think law enforcement is maybe saving kids from by asking them not to do it, but by enforcing it as well. It's kind of permanent, those pictures, aren't they?
Absolutely. Well, go ahead.
Let me ask, Hanna, let me put this spin on it, because you say in your article that most of the anti-sexting campaigns are a little bit like the sex education campaigns you see in conservative places, where they really emphasize abstinence, you know, which is just to say don't sext at all. But you point out in your article that approach can in fact be counterproductive.
Yeah, they just won't listen to you. I mean, I would say if you want to do abstinence, do intelligent abstinence. The analogy I said earlier, the seatbelt analogy. You know, probably this picture won't get out. Usually it doesn't. But, you know, it might. And if it does, in these rare cases, it can be disastrous. And then you can also talk to teenagers about circumstances in which it's more likely to get out, which is, in essence, you don't really know this person you're sending a picture to. You know, you guys don't really have a relationship. This is a guy who's just asking you for a picture. You know, he has no commitment to you. And again, I know commitment in quotes. These are teenagers. It's not like they're having lifelong relationships. But, you know, you don't even have any relationship with this guy. Just, you know, don't. In that case, I wouldn't do it, because your picture's more likely to get out. So there are lessons in there about respect and confidence and trust. You know, all the sorts of relationship lessons you would want a teenager to have anyway, which are applicable to sexting.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page from Jan, who writes, Doug Fabrizio and his guest are telling me to realize that sexting is okay between children and teens if it's consensual. So glad to have such enlightened people showing me and my family the way to happiness. What garbage. You get that reaction, I guess, right? I mean, this idea that what you're saying, or what I'm helping you say, is that this is all okay.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the what garbage, you know, a parent who thinks what garbage will probably also have a different view about teenage sexuality in general. You know, like maybe the same attitude you take about sex, you can think of it this way, you should take about sexting. So if you're a person who, you know, is more conservative and believes that teenagers, you know, should not be sexually active or be sexually experimenting, then you will think this is just as much garbage as that. I'm not that person. So I just don't want people to be more alarmed about sexting necessarily than they are about sex. So think about what you think about sex and then make your decision.
I guess it raises a question, and I hope this isn't too patronizing, but, you know, to the bigger question of how you properly deal with all of this in an environment where, you know, you point out in your article, few lawmakers so far are willing to concede that naked pictures of teenagers, even those that are voluntarily shared, are in any way acceptable. So maybe this is the question. Do you think, have the maturity to deal with sexting and to keep it in perspective at this point?
No, because these things happen slowly. For example, there are revenge porn laws for adults, you know, in which we've made it clear that if you take a picture of an ex, it's usually an ex-girlfriend, and spread it around to her employer and post it up on these revenge porn sites, you're in trouble, right? More and more states are passing revenge porn laws. So I think, you know, it sort of over time, the culture can start prosecuting correctly. So the kinds of stories we should be reading in the paper about this Virginia case that I wrote about, we shouldn't be reading a story that says sexting ring in high school. We should be reading a story that says two boys are arrested for putting up naked girls' pictures on an Instagram page, right? So we're shifting slightly so our minds kind of grasp what the crime is. And so then police officers have the guidance of the culture and the law in knowing, you know, immediately they could have focused this investigation on those two guys. That's so it's like these things happen slowly, but we really need to be clear about what the crime is.
So there is a role for religious leaders, for parents, for teachers and counselors. The question is, when do you get the cops involved?
Yeah, and I think, you know, mostly the cops are over-involved in these sexting cases.
Yeah.
And so you just need to, you know, when do you get the cops involved? You know, when there's abuse. There are certainly cases that come up, and these investigators told me all about them, in which somebody is really blackmailed into sending naked pictures. When there are age differences between the two that are big, you certainly get the cops involved. And when pictures are shared publicly without someone's consent, you get the cops involved.
Donald Lowe was in the end unable to really prosecute the case. I guess he sort of took a more, he wasn't able to pin down a lot of this stuff. So the case, I guess, hasn't really been resolved in this case in Virginia, really.
It has not been resolved. I mean, it's actually harder to track down the origins of, you know, who put up a page than you think it is. You know, people think it's just like DNA evidence, you got them right away. But sometimes it's harder. It's elusive who originated a page. And even if he had tracked down those guys, I think he would have had to face the hardest dilemma, which is, do I treat this like a teenage prank and, you know, treat it sort of lightly, or do I treat this as a serious crime? I don't think he had resolved that in his head.
It's Hannah Rosen. She is national correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine. Her article, Why Kids Sexed, appears in the November issue of the magazine. There's a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. She joined us from the offices of The Atlantic in Washington, D.C. Hannah Rosen, thanks.
I loved it. Thank you so much.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Michael Shea, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.